calls me Esme," she told him when she followed him into the weight room one morning. Usually he'd be nice to younger kids, but since he was told he had to be nice, he suddenly found he didn't want to be. "I know," Scythe Goddard told me. "You really shouldn't be here. These weights can be dangerous."
"And you're not supposed to be here without Scythe Chomsky to spot you," she pointed out,
then sat down on a bench press, showing no sign of leaving.
"If you like, we could play a game, or something, when you're done with your training."
"I don't really play games."
"Not even cards?"
"Not even cards."
"It must have been boring to be you."
"Yeah, well, it's not boring anymore."
"I'll teach you to play cards after dinner tomorrow," she announced.
And since Esme got what she wanted, Rowan was there at the appointed time, whether he wanted to be there or not.
"Esme must be kept happy,"
Scythe Volta reminded him after Rowan's card game with her.
"Why?"
Rowan asked. "Goddard doesn't seem to care about anyone who doesn't wear scythe robes, so why does he care about her?"
"Just be decent to her."
"I'm decent to everyone," Rowan pointed out. "In case you haven't noticed, I'm a decent person." Volta laughed.
"Hold on to that for as long as you can," he said,
as if doing so would be a very difficult thing. Then came the day Scythe Goddard threw a new wrinkle into the taut fabric of Rowan's life. It came without warning, as did all things Scythe Goddard threw at him. It was during Killcraft. Today, Rowan was working with two blades, daggers in each hand. Two blades were difficult for him. He favored his right, and had little dexterity with his left. Scythe Goddard loved to make it difficult for Rowan in these training sessions, and always judged him harshly when he didn't rise to some imaginary level of perfection. Yet Rowan had been surprising himself. He had been getting better at wielding weaponry, and had even drawn forth mild admissions of approval from Goddard. "Adequate," Goddard would say, or, "That wasn't entirely dismal." High praise from the man. And in spite of himself, Rowan felt satisfaction each time Goddard gave him approval. And he had to admit, he was beginning to like wielding deadly weapons. It had grown on him like any other sport. Skill for the sake of skill, and then a sense of accomplishment when he did well. On this particular day, things took a severe turn. It was evident from the moment he stepped out onto the lawn that something was up, because the dummies had not yet been put out. Instead, there were at least a dozen people milling about the lawn. He didn't get it at first. He should have known that something was different because all the junior scythes were there today to watch his training. Usually, it was just Goddard.
"What's going on here?" Rowan asked. "I can't do my training with people in the way. Tell them to clear out."
Scythe Rand laughed at him.
"You're charmingly dense," she said.
"This ought to be fun," said Scythe Chomsky, folding his arms, ready to relish what was to come.
And then, Rowan finally understood. On the lawn, the people weren't milling around, they were standing, evenly spaced. They were waiting for him. There were to be no more dummies, now his practice would be the real thing. Killcraft would now truly be Killcraft.
"No," Rowan said, shaking his head. "No, I can't do this."
"Oh, but you will," Scythe Goddard said calmly.
But I'm not ordained yet, I can't glean."
"You won't be gleaning,"
Scythe Volta said, putting a comforting hand on Rowan's shoulder.
"There are ambu drones waiting for each of them. As soon as you're done with them, they'll be rushed to the nearest revival center and be as good as new in a day or two."
But,
Rowan found he had no viable argument except to say,
"It isn't right."
"Listen here,"
Scythe Goddard said, stepping forward. "There are 13 people out on that lawn. Every single one of them is here by choice, and every single one of them is being well paid for the service provided. They all know why they're here. They know what their job is, they are more than happy to do it. And I expect the same from you. So do your job."
Rowan pulled out his blades and looked at them. Those blades would not be cutting into cotton today, but into flesh.
"Hearts and jugulars," Scythe Goddard told him. "Dispatch your subjects with speed. You will be timed."
Rowan wanted to protest, insist that he couldn't do it. But as much as his heart told him he couldn't, his mind knew the truth. Yes, he could. He had been training for precisely this.
All he had to do was dial his conscience down to zero. He knew he was capable of that, and it terrified him.
You are to take down 12 of them, Scythe Goddard told him, and leave the last one alive.
Why leave the last?
Because I said so. Come on, we don't have all day, grumbled Chomsky.
Volta threw Chomsky a withering glare, then spoke to Rowan with far more patience.
It's just like jumping into a cold pool. The anticipation is much worse than the reality. Take the leap, and I promise all will be well.
Rowan could leave. He could drop his blades and go into the house. He could prove himself to be a failure here and now, and perhaps not have to endure any more of this. But Volta believed in him. And so did Goddard, even if he wouldn't admit it aloud. For why would Goddard set this challenge before him if he didn't believe Rowan would rise to it? Rowan took a deep breath, gripped his blades tightly in both hands, and with a guttural war cry that drowned the alarms blaring in his soul, he launched himself forward. There were men, and there were women. The subjects represented different ages, ethnic mixes, and body types, from muscular to obese to gaunt. He yelled and screamed and grunted with every thrust, slice, and twist. He had trained well. The blades sunk in with perfect precision. Once he began, he found he couldn't stop. Bodies fell and he was on to the next and the next. They didn't fight back. They didn't run in fear. They just stood there and took it. They were no different from the dummies. He was covered in blood. It stung his eyes. The smell was thick in his nostrils. Finally, he came to the last one. It was a girl, his age, and there was a look on her face of resignation bordering on sorrow. He wanted to end that sorrow. He wanted to complete what he had begun. But he overrode the brutal imperative of the hunter in him. He forced himself not to swing his blades.
Do it,
she whispered.
Do it or I won't get paid.
But he dropped his blades to the grass. 12 deadish, one left alive. He turned to the scythes and they all began to applaud.
Well done, Scythe Goddard said,
more pleased than Rowan had ever seen him.
Very well done.
Embudrones began to descend from above, grasping his victims and spiriting them away to the nearest revival center. And Rowan found himself smiling. Something had torn loose inside of him. He didn't know whether it was a good thing or not. And while part of him felt like falling to his knees and hurling up breakfast, another part of him wanted to howl to the moon like a wolf. A year ago, if you told me that I'd know how to wield more than 24 types of blades, that I would become an expert at firearms, and that I would know at least 10 ways to end a life with my bare hands, I would have laughed and suggested that you ought to get your brain chemistry tweaked. Amazing what can happen in just a few short months. Training under Scythe Goddard is different from under Scythe Faraday. It's intense, physical, and I can't deny that I'm getting better at everything I do. If I am a weapon, then I'm being sharpened against a grindstone every day. My second conclave is coming up in a few weeks. The first trial was nothing more than a simple question. I'm told it will be different this next time. There's no telling what the apprentices will be expected to do. One thing's for sure, there will be serious consequences for me if I don't perform to Goddard's liking. I have every confidence that I will. From the Journal of Rowan Damish, Scythe Apprentice. 25. Proxy of Death. The engineer liked to believe that his work at magnetic propulsion laboratories was useful, even though it had always appeared pointless. Magnetic trains were already moving as efficiently as they could. Applications for private transportation needed little more than tweaking. There was no more new and improved. There was just the trick of different. New styles, and advertisements to convince that stylishness was all the rage. But the basic technology remained exactly the same. In theory, however, there were new uses that were yet to be tapped. Or why else would the Thunderhead put them to work? They were project managers who knew more about the ultimate goal of the work they did, but no one had all the pieces. Still, there was speculation. It had long been believed that a combination of solar wind and magnetic propulsion would be required to move about in space with any efficiency. True, the prospect of space travel had been out of favor for many years. but that didn't mean it would always be. There had once been missions to colonize Mars, to explore Jupiter's moons, and even to launch to the stars beyond. But every mission had ended in utter and disastrous failure. Ships blew up, colonists died, and in deep space death meant death, just as completely as if they had been gleaned. The idea of irrevocable death without the controlled hand of a scythe was too much to bear for a world that had conquered mortality. The public outcry shut down all space exploration. Earth was our sole home, and would remain so. Which is why, the engineer suspected, the Thunderhead moved forward on these projects so carefully and so slowly as to not draw the public's attention. It was by no means underhanded, because the Thunderhead was incapable of underhandedness. It was merely discreet. Wisely discreet. One day, perhaps, the Thunderhead would announce that while everyone was looking the other way, humanity had achieved a sustainable presence beyond the bounds of planet Earth. The engineer looked forward to that day, and fully expected he'd live to see it. He had no reason to expect that he wouldn't. Until the day a team of scythes laid siege to his research facility. Rowan was awakened at dawn by a towel hurled at his face.
"Get up, Sleeping Beauty," Scythe Volta said. "Shower and get dressed. Today's the day."
"Today's what day?"
Rowan said, still too groggy to sit up.
"Gleaning day,"
said Volta.
"You mean you guys actually glean? I thought you just partied and spent other people's money."
"Just get yourself ready, smartass."
When Rowan turned off his shower, he heard the chop of helicopter blades, and when he came out onto the lawn, it was waiting for them. It was no surprise to Rowan that it was painted royal blue and studded with glistening stars. Everything in Scythe Goddard's life was a testament to his ego. The other three scythes were already out front, practicing their best kill moves. Their robes were bulky and clearly loaded down with all nature of weaponry sheathed within the folds. Chomsky torched a potted shrub with a flamethrower.
"Really?" said Rowan. "A flamethrower?"
Chomsky shrugged.
"No law against it. And anyway, what business is it of yours?"
Goddard strode out of the mansion.
"What are you waiting for? Let's go!"
As if they hadn't all been waiting on him. The moment was charged with the adrenaline of anticipation, and as they strode toward the waiting helicopter, Rowan, for an instant, had an image of them as superheroes, until he remembered what their true purpose was and the image shattered.
"How many are you going to glean?"
he asked Scythe Volta, but Volta just shook his head and pointed to his ear. Too loud to hear Rowan over the chopper blades, which made the scythe's robes flail like flags in a storm as they crossed the lawn. Rowan did some calculations. Scythes were charged with 5 gleanings per week, and to the best of his knowledge, these 4 hadn't taken a life in the 3 months that Rowan had been there. That meant they could glean about 250 today and still be within their quota. This wasn't going to be a gleaning. It was going to be a massacre. Rowan hesitated, falling back as the others got in. Volta noticed.
"Is there a problem?"
Volta shouted over the deafening chop of the blades. But even if Rowan could make himself heard, he would never be understood. This is what Goddard and his disciples did. It was how they operated. This was business as usual. Could this ever be that way for him? He thought to his latest training sessions, the ones with living targets. The feeling he had when he had rendered all but one deadish. Revulsion, fighting a primal sense of victory. He felt that now, as he stood at the entrance to the helicopter. With each step deeper into Goddard's world, it became harder and harder to retreat. All 4 scythes were looking at him now. They were ready to go on their mission. The only thing holding them back was Rowan.
"I am not one of them," he told himself. "I will not be gleaning. I will only be there to observe."
He willed himself to step up into the helicopter, pulled the door closed, and they rose skyward.
"Never been up in one of these, have you?"
Volta asked, misreading Rowan's apprehension.
"No, never."
"It's the only way to travel,"
Scythe Rand said.
"We are the angels of death," said Scythe Goddard. "It is only fitting that we swoop in from the heavens."
They flew south over Fulcrum City to the suburbs beyond. All the way, Rowan silently hoped the helicopter would crash, but he realized what a pointless exercise that would be. because even if it did, they'd all be revived by the weekend. A helicopter landed on the main building's rooftop heliport. It was unexpected, unannounced, which never happened. The Thunderhead piloted just about everything airborne, and even if it was an off-grid chopper, someone on board would always announce their approach and request clearance. The thing just dropped from the sky and onto the roof. The closest security guard bounded up the stairs from the sixth floor and onto the roof, in time to see the Scythes stepping out. Four of them, blue, green, yellow, and orange, and a boy with an apprentice armband. The guard stood there, slack-jawed, unsure what to do. He thought to call this in to the main office, but realized that doing so might get him gleaned. The female Scythe, in green with witchy dark hair, and a Pan-Asian leaning to her, approached him, grinning.
"Knock, knock,"
she said. He was too stunned to respond.
"I said, knock, knock."
"Who's there?" he finally responded.
She reached into her robe, producing the most awful-looking knife the men had ever seen. But her arm was grabbed by the Scythe in blue before she could use it.
"Don't waste it on him, Ein," he said to her.
The Scythe in green put her knife away and shrugged.
"Guess you'll miss the punchline."
Then she stormed past him with the others and down the stairs into the building. He caught the gaze of the apprentice, who lagged a few yards behind the others.
"What should I do?"
he asked the boy.
"Get out," the boy told him. "And don't look back."
So the guard did what he was told. He crossed to the far stairwell, bounded all the way down, burst out of the emergency exit, and didn't stop running until he was too far away to hear the screams.
"We'll start up here on the sixth floor and work our way down," Goddard told the others.
They came out of the stairwell to see a woman waiting for the elevator. She gasped and froze.
"Boo,"
said Scythe Chomsky. The woman flinched, dropping the folders she carried. Rowan knew that any of the Scythes on a whim could have taken her out. She must have known that, too, because she braced for it.
"How high is your security clearance?" Goddard asked her.
"Level one,"
she told him.
"Is that good?"
She nodded, and he took her security badge.
"Thank you," he said. "You get to live."
And he moved toward a locked door, swiping the card to gain entrance. Rowan found himself getting lightheaded, and realized he was beginning to hyperventilate.
"I should wait here," he told them. "I can't glean, I should wait here."
"No way,"
said Chomsky. "You come with us." But what use will I be? I'll just be in the way."
Then Scythe Rand kicked in the glass of an emergency case, pulled out a fire hatchet and handed it to him.
"Here,"
she said.
"Break stuff."
"Why?"
She winked at him.
"Because you can."
The employees in Suite 601, which took up the entire north half of the floor, had no warning. Scythe Goddard and his scythes strode into the center of activity.
"Attention,"
he announced in full theatrical voice.
"Attention, all. You have been selected for gleaning today. You are commanded to step forward and meet your demise."
Murmurs, gasps, and cries of shock. No one stepped forward. No one ever did. Goddard nodded to Chomsky, Volta, and Rand, and the four advanced through the maze of cubicles and offices, leaving nothing living in their wake.
"I am your completion," intoned Goddard. "I am your deliverance. I am your portal to the mysteries beyond this life."
Blades and bullets and flames. The office was catching fire. Alarms began to blare. Sprinklers gushed forth icy water from the ceiling. The doomed were caught between fire and water, and the deadly sights of four master hunters. No one stood a chance.
"I am your final word, your omega, your bringer of peace and rest. Embrace me."
No one embraced him. Mostly people cowered and pleaded for mercy, but the only mercy shown was the speed at which they were dispatched.
"Yesterday you were gods, today you are mortal. Your death is my gift to you. Accept it with grace and humility."
So focused were the Scythes that none of them noticed Rowan slipping out behind them and crossing to Suite 602, where he pounded on the glass door until someone came, and Rowan could warn him what was coming.
"Take the back stairs," he told the men. "Get as many out as you can. Don't ask questions. Just go."
If the man had any doubts,
They were chased away by the sounds of desperation and despair coming from just across the hall. A few minutes later, when Goddard, Volta, and Chomsky were done with Suite 601, they crossed the hall to find Suite 602 empty, save for Rowan, swinging his fire hatchet at computers and desks and everything in his path, doing exactly as he was told to do. The scythes moved faster than the flames, faster than the flow of workers trying to escape. Volta and Chomsky blocked two of the three stairwells. Rand made her way to the main entrance and stood like a goalie, taking out anyone trying to escape through the front doors. Goddard spouted his ritualistic litany as he moved through the panicked mob, switching his weapons as it suited him. And Rowan swung his hatchet at anything that would shatter, then secretly directed whoever he could toward the one unguarded stairwell. It was over in less than 15 minutes. The building was in flames. The helicopter was hovering above, and the scythes strode out of the front entrance, like the four horsemen of the post-mortal apocalypse. Rowan brought up the rear, dragging his hatchet on the marble until he dropped it with a clatter. Before them were half a dozen fire trucks and Embu drones, and behind that hordes of survivors. Some ran when they saw the scythes coming out, but just as many stayed, their fascination overcoming their terror.
"You see," Goddard told Rowan,
"the firefighters can't interfere with a scythe action. They'll let the whole thing burn down. And as for the survivors, we have a wonderful public relations opportunity."
Then he stepped forward and spoke loudly to those who hadn't fled.
"Our gleaning is complete," he announced. "To those who survive, we grant immunity. Come forward to claim it."
He held out his hand, the one that bore his ring. The other scythes followed his lead and did the same. No one moved at first, probably thinking it was a trick. But in a few moments, one ash-stained employee stumbled forward, followed by another, and another. And then the entire mob was apprehensively coming toward them. The first few knelt and kissed the scythe's rings, and once the others saw that this was for real, they surged forward, mobbing the scythes.
"Easy!" shouted Volta. "One at a time!"
But the same mob mentality that propelled their escape now pushed them toward those life-saving rings. All of a sudden, no one seemed to remember their dead co-workers. Then, as the crowd around them got denser and more agitated, Goddard pulled back his hand, removed his ring, and handed it to Rowan.
"I tire of this," Goddard said. "Take it. Share in the adoration."
"But I can't. I'm not ordained."
"You can use it if I give you permission as a proxy," Goddard told him. "And right now you have my permission."
Rowan put it on, but it wouldn't stay, so he switched it to his index finger where it was a bit more snug. Then he held out his hand as the other scythes did. The crush of people didn't care which finger the ring was on, or even whose hand it was on. They practically climbed over one another to kiss it, and to thank him for his justice, his love, and his mercy, calling him Your Honor, not even noticing he wasn't a scythe.
"Welcome to life as a god,"
Scythe Volta said to him, while behind them, the building burned to the ground.
"We are wise but not perfect, insightful but not all-seeing. We know that by establishing the scythedom, we will be doing something very necessary. But we, the first scythes, still have our misgivings. Human nature is both predictable and mysterious, prone to great and sudden advances, yet still mired in despicable self-interest. Our hope is that by a set of 10 simple, straightforward laws, we can avoid the pitfalls of human fallibility. My greatest hope is that, in time, our wisdom will become as perfect as is our knowledge. And if this experiment of ours fails, we have also embedded a way to escape it. May the Thunderhead help us all, if we ever need that escape." From the Gleaning Journal of H.S. Prometheus, the first World Supreme Blade. 26. Not like the others. That night, they feasted, although Rowan could not dig up an appetite, no matter how deep he mined. Goddard ate enough for everyone. He was invigorated by the day's hunt, like a vampire sucking in the life force of its victims. He was more charming, more suave than ever, saying things to make everyone laugh.
"How easy," thought Rowan, "to fall in with him.
to be stroked into his elite club, just as the others had been. Clearly, Chomsky and Rand were cut from a similar cloth as Goddard. They held not the slightest illusion of conscience. But unlike Goddard, they held no delusions of grandeur. They gleaned for sport, for the joy of it. And as Scythe Rand so accurately put it, because they can. They were more than happy to wield their weapons while Goddard inhabited his role as the angel of death. Rowan couldn't be sure if the men believed it, or if it was all artifice. Theatricality, to add flair to the show. Scythe Volta, though, was different. Yes, he stormed the office building and gleaned his share, just as the others had. But he said little as their god machine carried them home across the sky. And now, at dinner, he barely touched the food on his plate. He kept getting up to wash his hands. He probably thought no one noticed, but Rowan did. And so did Esme.
Scythe Volta is always cranky after a gleaning, Esme leaned over to tell Rowan. Don't stare at him, or he'll throw something at you.
Halfway through dinner, Goddard asked for a final count.
We gleaned 263,
Rand told him.
We're ahead of our quota now. We'll have to glean fewer next time.
Goddard slammed his fist down on the table in disgust.
The damn quota hobbles us all. If it weren't for the quota, every day could be like today.
Then Goddard turned to Scythe Volta and asked how his task was coming. It was Volta's job to set appointments with the families of the deceased, so that they could be granted the obligatory immunity.
I've spent the whole day reaching out to each family, Volta said. They'll be lining up at the outer gate first thing tomorrow morning.
We should let them onto the grounds, Goddard said with a smirk. They can watch Rowan train on the lawn.
I hate the bereaved,
Rand said as she stabbed a fresh piece of meat with her fork and dragged it to her plate.
They always have such awful oral hygiene. My ring always reeks after an hour of granting bereavement immunity.
Unable to stomach any more, Rowan excused himself.
I promised Esme I'd play cards with her after dinner, and it's getting late.
There was no truth in that, but he threw a glance to Esme and she nodded, pleased to be part of an impromptu conspiracy.
But you'll miss the creme brulee, said Goddard. More for us, said Chomsky,
shoving a forkful of prime rib into his maw. Rowan and Esme went to the game room and played gin rummy, mercifully undisturbed by talk of gleaning and quotas and the kissing of rings. Rowan was thankful that the suicide king held the monopoly on misery in this room.
We should get others to join us, Esme suggested. Then we can play hearts or spades. You can't play those games with just two.
I have no interest in playing cards with the scythes, Rowan told her flatly.
Not them, silly. I mean the servants.
She picked up his discarded nine, the second one he fed to her, as if he didn't know she was collecting them. Letting her win today was payment for helping him escape the dining room.
I play cards with the poolman's son sometimes, she told him. But they don't like me very much, on account of this used to be their house. Now they all share a room in the servants' quarters.
Then she added,
You're sleeping in one of their rooms, you know, so I'll bet they don't like you much either.
I'm sure they don't like any of us.
Probably not.
Maybe it was because Esme was young, but she seemed entirely oblivious to the things that weighed so heavily on Rowan. Perhaps she knew better than to question things, or to pass judgment on what she saw. She accepted her situation at face value and never spoke ill of her benefactor. Or more accurately, her captor, for she was clearly Goddard's prisoner, even though she might not see it that way. Hers was a gilded cage, but it was a cage, nonetheless. Still, her ignorance was her bliss, and Rowan decided not to shatter her illusion that she was free. Rowan picked up an ace which he needed for his hand, but discarded it anyway.
Does Goddard ever talk to you?
He asked Esme.
Of course he talks to me, she said. He's always asking me how I am, and if there's anything I need. And if there is, he always makes sure I get it. Just last week, I asked for—
No, not that kind of talking, said Rowan, cutting her off.
I mean, real talking. Has he ever hinted as to why you matter so much to him?
Esme didn't answer. Instead, she laid down her cards, nines over threes.
Rummy, she said. Loser shuffles.
Rowan gathered the cards.
Scythe Goddard must have had a good reason to let you live, and to grant you immunity. Aren't you at all curious?
Esme shrugged and stayed tight-lipped. It was only after Rowan dealt the next hand that she said,
Actually, Scythe Goddard didn't grant me immunity. He can glean me anytime he wants, but he doesn't.
Then she smiled.
That makes me even more special, don't you think?
They played 4 games. 1 Esme won fair and square, 2 Rowan let her win, and 1 Rowan won, so it wouldn't be as obvious that he had thrown the others. By the time they were done, dinner had broken up, and the others were going about their particular evening routines. Rowan avoided everyone and tried to go straight to his room, but on his way, he heard something that gave him pause. There was a faint sobbing coming from Scythe Volta's room. He listened at the door to make sure it wasn't his imagination, then turned the knob. The door wasn't locked. He pushed it open slightly and peered inside. Scythe Volta was there, sitting on his bed, head in hands. His body heaved with sobs that he tried to stifle but could not. It was a few moments before he looked up and saw Rowan. Volta's sorrow instantly turned to fury.
Who the hell said you could come in here? Get out!
He grabbed the nearest object, a glass paperweight, and hurled it at Rowan, just as Esme had suggested he might. It would have left a pretty nasty gash on Rowan's head had it connected. But Rowan ducked and the thing hit the door, leaving a substantial dent in the wood instead of in Rowan's skull. Rowan could have retreated. That probably would have been the most judicious course of action, but leaving well enough alone was not Rowan's strong point. He was notoriously skilled at sticking his nose where it didn't belong. He stepped into the room and closed the door behind him, preparing to dodge the next blunt object hurled his way. You have to be quieter, if you don't want anyone to hear you, he told Volta.
If you tell anyone, I will make your life a living hell.
Rowan laughed at that, because it implied his life wasn't already that.
You think that's funny? I'll show you funny. Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh. I wasn't laughing at you, if that's what you think.
Since Volta was no longer throwing things and wasn't chasing him out, Rowan grabbed a chair and sat down, far enough away to give Volta some space.
Today was hard, Rowan said.
I don't blame you.
What do you know about it?
Snapped Volta.
I know you're not like the others, said Rowan.
Not really. Volta looked up at him then, his eyes red from tears that he didn't try to hide anymore.
There's something wrong with me, you mean?
Volta looked down again, clenching his fists. But Rowan didn't move, because he didn't expect to get a beating. He suspected that Volta would use his own fists against himself if he could.
Scythe Goddard is the future, Volta said. I don't want to be part of the past, don't you understand?
But you hated today, didn't you? Even more than me. Because you weren't just watching, you were a part of it.
And you'll be a part of it soon, too.
Maybe not, said Rowan.
Oh, you will be. The moment you get your ring and kill that pretty little girlfriend of yours, you'll know there's no turning back for you either.
Rowan swallowed, trying to fight down what little bit of dinner he had eaten. Citra's face bloomed in his mind. But he pushed the image away. He wouldn't let himself think about her now. Rowan knew he was out on a limb with Volta. The only thing to do was shimmy to its precarious end.
You only pretend to like gleaning, he said to Volta. But you hate it more than you've ever hated anything.
Your mentor was Scythe Nehru, right? He's very old school, which means he chose you for your conscience. You don't want to take life, and you definitely don't want to take dozens upon dozens at a time. Volta leapt up, moving faster than seemed possible. He lifted Rowan up and pushed him against the wall with a bruising slam that made Rowan sorely miss his pain-killing nanites.
You will never repeat that to anyone, do you hear me? I've come too far to have my position jeopardized. I won't be blackmailed by a snot-nosed apprentice.
Is that what you think I'm doing? Blackmailing you?
Don't toy with me, growled Volta. I know why you're here.
Rowan was genuinely disappointed. I thought you knew me. A moment more and Volta loosened his grip.
Nobody knows anyone, do they?
He said. I promise I won't tell anyone, and I don't want anything from you. Volta finally backed off.
I'm sorry. After you've been surrounded by so much scheming, you start to think that's how everyone plays.
He sat back down on the bed.
I believe you, because I know you're better than that. In fact, I knew from the moment Goddard brought you in, he sees you as a challenge. Because if he can turn one of Faraday's apprentices to his way of thinking, it proves he can turn anyone.
Then it occurred to Rowan that Volta wasn't all that much older than him. He had always feigned a confidence that made him seem older.
but now his vulnerability revealed the truth. He was 20 at most, which meant he'd only been a scythe for a couple of years. Rowan didn't know the path that led him from an old guard scythe to Goddard, but he could imagine. He could see how a junior scythe might gravitate toward Goddard's flash and charisma. After all, Goddard promised his disciples anything a human heart could desire, in exchange for the complete abdication of one's conscience. In a profession where a conscience was a liability, who would want one? Rowan sat down again and pulled his chair close enough to Volta to whisper.
"I'll tell you what I think,"
Rowan said.
"Goddard isn't a scythe, he's a killer."
It was the first time Rowan dared to say it aloud.
"There's a lot written about killers from the mortal age. Monsters like Jack the Ripper or Charlie Manson or Cyber Sally. And the only difference between them and Goddard is that people let Goddard get away with it. The mortals knew how wrong it was, but somehow we've forgotten."
"Yeah, but even if that's true, what can anyone do about it?"
asked Volta.
"The future comes whether we want it to or not. Rand and Chomsky and the dozens of other sick, twisted bastards longing to be in Goddard's inner circle are going to dominate that future. I'm sure the founding scythes must be rolling in their graves, but the point is, they are in their graves, and they're not coming back anytime soon."
Volta took a deep breath and wiped the last of his tears.
"For your sake, Rowan, I hope you come to love killing as much as Goddard does. It would make your life so much easier, so much more rewarding."
The suggestion weighed heavily on him. A month ago, Rowan would have denied that he could ever become such a monster, but now he wasn't so sure. The pressure to surrender was greater every day. He had to hope that if Volta had never truly surrendered to the darkness, then maybe he might stand a chance as well. There is no official media coverage of gleanings, much to the chagrin of the more publicly minded scythes. Not even large-scale gleanings get on the news. Even so, plenty of personal pictures and videos of gleanings are uploaded to the Thunderhead, providing a guerrilla record, which is so much more exciting and enticing than anything official. Notoriety and infamy quickly evolve into celebrity and fame for scythes, and the most brazen acts harden further into legend. Some scythes find the fame addictive and seek greater and greater celebrity. Others would rather remain anonymous. I cannot deny that I am legend, not for the simple gleanings I do now, but for the audacious ones I did more than 150 years ago. As if I weren't already immortal enough, I am further immortalized on collectible cards. The newer ones are prized by schoolchildren. The older ones are worth a fortune to hardcore collectors, regardless of the condition. I am legend. Yet every day, I wish that I was not.
From the Gleaning Journal of H.S. Curie. 27. Harvest Conclave. Citra's secret investigation led to some surprises she couldn't wait to share with Rowan when she finally saw him at Harvest Conclave. She certainly couldn't share them with Scythe Curie. The two had come to trust each other, and the Scythe would have seen Citra secretly using her online credentials as a flagrant violation of that trust. Citra's life had taken a very different turn from Rowan's. She did not attend loud, lavish parties, nor did she train against live subjects. She helped cook quiet meals for heartbroken families and sparred with a black belt Bokator bot. She created tinctures and studied the practical use of deadly poisons in Scythe Curie's personal apothecary and toxic herb garden. She learned about all the infamous acts of both the best and the worst scythes in history. In the past, it was usually laziness, prejudice, or lack of foresight that made a bad scythe, Citra had discovered. There were those who seemed to glean too many neighbors because they couldn't be bothered to look further. There were those who, in spite of repeated disciplinary action, would glean people with specific ethnic traits. As for poor judgment, there were plenty of examples there as well, such as Scythe Sartre, who thought it was a good idea to do all of his gleanings at rodeos, thereby destroying the sport entirely, since no one would attend a rodeo for fear of being gleaned. Of course, the bad scythes weren't all in the past, but instead of bad, they were now called innovative and forward-thinking. like the innovative bloodbaths of Side Goddard and his killer cronies. The mass gleaning at Magnetic Propulsion Laboratory, although never reported officially, was big news. And there were plenty of private videos uploaded to the Thunderhead, showing Goddard and his disciples doling out immunity like bread to the poor. Rowan was right there in the middle of it. Citra didn't know what to think about that. The world has a talent for rewarding bad behavior with stardom, Scythe Curie said as she viewed some of the videos that had been uploaded. Then she got a bit pensive. I know the pitfalls of being a celebrity, Scythe, she confessed, although Citra already knew. I was headstrong and stupid in my early days. I thought that by gleaning just the right people at just the right time, I could change the world for the better. I believed in my arrogance that I had a keen grasp of the big picture that others lacked. But of course I was just as limited as anyone else. When I gleaned the president and his cabinet, it shook the world. But the world was already shaking just fine without me. They called me Miss Massacre, and as time went on, that changed to the Grand Dame of Death. I spent more than 100 years trying to fade into anonymity, but even the youngest of children know me. I am the boogeyman parents use to get their children to behave. Be good, or the Grand Dame will get you. Scythe Curie shook her head sadly. Most celebrity is fleeting. But when you're a scythe, your defining deeds stand forever. Take my advice, Citra, and remain undefined. You might be a celebrity scythe, Citra pointed out. But even at your worst, you are nothing like Goddard. No, I wasn't, thank goodness, Scythe Curie said. I never took life for sport. You see, there are some who seek celebrity to change the world, and others who seek it to ensnare the world. Goddard is of the second kind. And then she said something that guaranteed Citra many a sleepless night. I wouldn't trust your friend Rowan anymore. Goddard is as corrosive as acid hurled in the eye. The kindest thing you can do is win that ring when Winter Conclave comes and glean the boy quickly, before that acid burns any deeper than it already has. Citra was glad that Winter Conclave was still months away. It was Harvest Conclave she had to worry about. At first, Citra had looked forward to September and the Harvest Conclave, but as it approached, she began to dread it. It wasn't the upcoming test that troubled her. She felt she was prepared for whatever trials would be thrown at the apprentices. What she dreaded was seeing Rowan, because she had no idea what all these months with Goddard had done to him. Win that ring, and glean him quickly, Scythe Curie had said. Well, Citra didn't have to worry about that now. She had 4 months until that decision would be made. But the clock never stopped ticking. It moved inexorably toward one of their deaths. Harvest Conclave took place on a clear but blustery September day. While a storm had kept many spectators away from the last conclave, they gathered in force today, on the street before the Fulcrum City Capitol building. Even more peace officers than before were posted to keep the gawking crowds back. Some scythes, mostly the old guard ones, arrived on foot, choosing a humble walk from their hotels over a more flashy arrival. Others pulled up in high-end cars, choosing to make the most of their celebrity status. News crews aimed their cameras, but mostly kept their distance. This was, after all, not a red carpet. No questions, no interviews. But there was certainly a lot of preening. Scythes waved to the cameras and squared their shoulders, standing tall so they'd look their best on screen. Scythe Goddard and his crew showed up in a limousine, royal blue, studded with mock diamonds, just in case there was any question as to who was inside. As Goddard and his entourage emerged, the crowd oohed and awed, as if their dazzling appearance rivaled a display of fireworks. There he is! It's him! He's so handsome! He's so scary! He's so well-groomed! Goddard took a moment to turn to the crowd and sweep his hand in a royal wave. Then he focused on one girl from the audience, held her gaze, pointed at her, then continued on up the stairs, saying nothing. He's so strange. He's so mysterious. He's so charming. As for the girl he singled out, she was left impressed and terrified and confused by his momentary attention, which was precisely the intent. So focused was the crowd on Goddard and his colorful entourage No one much noticed Rowan bringing up the rear as they climbed the steps to the entrance. Goddard's crew weren't the only scythes up for the show. Scythe Kierkegaard had a crossbow slung over his shoulder. Not that he had any intention of using it today, it was merely a part of the spectacle. Still, he could have aimed it at just about anyone in the audience and taken them out. The knowledge of that made the crowd all the more excited. No one had ever been gleaned on the Capitol steps before a conclave, but that didn't mean that it couldn't happen. While most scythes approached down the main avenue, Scythe Curie and Citra made their entrance from a side street, to avoid being the focus of the crowd's attention for as long as possible. As the stately scythe pushed through the crowd of onlookers, a rumble erupted from the people closest to her, as they realized who it was moving among them. People reached out to touch her silky lavender robe. She endured this as a matter of course, but one man actually grabbed the fabric and she had to slap his hand away.
"Careful," she said, meeting his eye. "I don't take kindly to the violation of my person."
"I apologize, Your Honor," said the man.
Then he reached for her hand, intent on touching her ring, but she pulled her hand away from him.
"Don't even think about it."
Citra pushed her way in front of Scythe Curie to help clear a path for her.
"Maybe we should have taken a limo," Citra said. "At least that way we wouldn't have to fight our way through." "That's always been a little too elitist for me," Curie said.
As they cleared the crowd, a sudden gust came down the wide Capitol steps, catching Scythe Curie's long silver hair and blowing it back like a bridal train, making her look almost mystical.
"I knew I should have braided it today," she said.
As she and Citra climbed the white marble steps, someone to their left shouted, "We love you!" Scythe Curie stopped and turned, unable to find the speaker, so she addressed them all.
"Why?"
she demanded. But now, under her cool scrutiny, no one responded.
"I could end your existence at any moment. Why love me?"
Still, no one answered. But the exchange attracted a cameraman who moved forward, getting a little too close. Scythe Curie smacked the camera so hard it wrenched the man's whole body around and he nearly dropped it.
"Mind your manners," said the scythe.
"Yes, Your Honor. Sorry, Your Honor."
She continued up the steps with Citra behind her.
"Hard to imagine that I used to love this attention. Now I'd avoid it entirely if I could. You didn't seem this tense at the last conclave," Citra noted. "That's because I didn't have an apprentice being tested. Instead, I was the one testing other scythes' apprentices."
A test that Citra had failed, spectacularly. But she didn't feel like bringing that up.
"Do you know what today's test will be?"
Citra asked as they reached the top of the stairs and stepped into the entry vestibule.
"No. But I do know that it's being administered by Scythe Cervantes, and he tends to be very physically minded. For all I know, he'll have you tilting at windmills."
As before, the scythes greeted one another in the grand rotunda, waiting for the assembly room doors to open. Breakfast was set out on tables in the center of the rotunda, featuring a pyramid of Danish that must have taken hours to assemble, but seconds to fall as scythes carelessly took the lower Danish without regard to the ones above. The waitstaff scrambled to gather the fallen pastries before they could be ground underfoot. Scythe Curie found it all very amusing.
It was foolhardy of the caterer to think that scythes would leave anything in a state of order.
Citra spotted Junior Scythe Goodall, the girl who had been ordained at the last conclave. She had her robes made by Claude de Glace, one of the world's preeminent fashion designers. It had been a monumental mistake, because today's designers were all about shocking people out of their happy place. Scythe Goodall's orange and blue striped robe made her look more like a circus clown than a scythe. Citra couldn't help but notice how Goddard and his junior scythes were the center of even more attention than at the Vernal Conclave. Although there were a number of scythes who turned a cold shoulder, even more crowded them, seeking to ingratiate themselves.
"There are more and more scythes who think like Goddard,"
Scythe Curie said quietly to Citra.
"They've slipped between the cracks like snakes, infiltrating our ranks, supplanting the best of us like weeds."
Citra thought about Faraday, a decent scythe most certainly choked out by the weeds.
"The killers are rising to power,"
Scythe Curie said.
"And if they do, the days of this world will be very dark indeed. It is left to the truly honorable scythes to stand firm against it. I look forward to the day you join in that fight." "Thank you, Your Honor,"
Citra had no problem fighting the good fight if she became a Scythe. It was the events that would lead up to it that she couldn't bear to consider. Scythe Curie went off to greet several of the old guard Scythes who held true to the Founder's ideals. That's when Citra finally spotted Rowan. He didn't bask in the false glow of Goddard. Instead, he was his own little center of attention. He was surrounded by other apprentices and even a few junior Scythes. They chatted. They laughed. And Citra found herself feeling slighted that Rowan hadn't even sought her out. Rowan had, in fact, tried to find her, but by the time Citra entered the rotunda, Rowan had already been set upon by unexpected admirers. Some were envious of his position with Goddard, others were just curious, and others were clearly hoping to attach themselves to his rising star. Political positioning started young in the Scythedom.
"You were there, at that office building, weren't you?"
one of the other apprentices said, a spat. One of the new ones, at Conclave for the first time.
"I saw you in the videos."
"He wasn't just there," said another spat. "He had Goddard's freaking ring, handing out immunity."
"Wow, is that even allowed?"
Rowan shrugged.
"Goddard said it was. And anyway, it wasn't like I asked him to give me his ring, he just did it."
One of the junior Scythes sighed wistfully.
"Man, he must really like you if he let you do that."
The thought that Goddard might actually like him made Rowan uncomfortable, because the things that Goddard liked, Rowan categorically despised.
"So, what's he like?"
one girl asked.
"Like, no one I've ever met," Rowan told her.
"I wish I was his apprentice,"
said one of the spats, then grimaced like he had just bitten into a rancid cheese Danish.
"I was taken on by Scythe Mao."
Scythe Mao, Rowan knew, was another showboater, enjoying the celebrity of his public image. He was notoriously independent and didn't align himself with the old guard or the new. Rowan didn't know if he was a man who voted his own conscience or sold his vote to the highest bidder. Faraday would have known. There were so many things Rowan missed about being Faraday's apprentice. The inside scoop was one of them.
"Goddard and his junior Scythes totally owned the Capitol steps when they came up,"
said an apprentice Rowan remembered from last conclave, the one who knew his poisons.
"They look so good.
Have you decided what color you'll be? And what jewels you'll have on your robe?"
a girl asked, suddenly hanging on his arm like a fast-growing vine. He didn't know which would be more awkward, pulling out of her grip or not.
"Invisible,"
Rowan said.
"I'll come up the Stays House steps naked."
"Those'll be some jewels," quipped one of the junior Scythes, and everyone laughed. Then Citra pushed her way through, and Rowan felt as if he was caught doing something he shouldn't.
"Citra, hi,"
he said. It felt so forced. He just wanted to take it back and find another way to say it. He shrugged out of the vine girl's grip, but it was too late because Citra had seen it.
"Looks like you've made a lot of friends,"
Citra said.
"No, not really," he said.
Then realized he'd just insulted them all.
"I mean, we're all friends, right? We're in the same boat."
"Same boat,"
repeated Citra with deadpan dullness, but daggers in her eyes as sharp as the ones that used to hang in Faraday's weapons den.
"Good to see you too, Rowan."
Then she strode away.
"Let her go,"
said the vine girl. "She'll be history after the next conclave anyway, right?" Rowan didn't even excuse himself as he left them. He caught up with Citra quickly, which told him she really wasn't trying all that hard to get away. This was a good sign. He gently grabbed her arm and she turned to him.
"Hey,"
he said.
"I'm sorry about back there."
"No, I get it,"
she said.
"You're a big deal now. You have to flaunt it."
"It's not like that. Do you think I wanted them fawning all over me like that? Come on. You know me better."
Citra hesitated.
"It's been 4 months,"
she said.
4 months can change a person."
That much was true. But some things hadn't changed. Rowan knew what she wanted to hear, but that would just be another dance, another bit of posturing. So he told her the truth.
"It's good to see you, Citra,"
he said.
"But it hurts to see you. It hurts a lot, and I don't know what to do about it."
He could tell that reached her because her eyes began to glisten with tears that she blinked away before they could spill.
"I know. I hate that it has to be this way."
"I'll tell you what," said Rowan. "Let's not even think about Winter Conclave right now. Let's be in the here and now and let Winter Conclave
take care of itself.
Citra nodded.
Agreed.
Then she took a deep breath.
Let's take a walk. There's something I have to show you.
They walked along the outer edge of the rotunda, passing the archways where scythes wheeled and dealed. Citra pulled out her phone and projected a series of holograms into her palm, cupping it so no one but Rowan could see.
I dug these out of the Thunderhead's back brain.
How did you do that?
Never mind how. What's important is that I did. And what I found.
The holograms were of Scythe Faraday on the streets near his home.
These are from his last day,
Citra said.
I was able to retrace at least some of his steps that day.
But why?
Just watch.
The hologram showed him being let into someone's home.
That's the house of the woman he introduced us to at the market. He spent a few hours there. Then he went to this cafe.
Citra swiped to another video, showing him going into the restaurant.
I think he may have met someone there, but I don't know who.
Okay, said Rowan. So he was saying goodbye to people. So far it seems consistent with the things someone would do if it were their last day on Earth.
Citra swiped again. The next video showed him going up to the stairs to a train station.
This was 5 minutes before he died,
Citra said.
We know that it happened at that station. But guess what? The camera on that train platform had been vandalized, supposedly by unsavories. It was down for the entire day, so there's no visual record of what actually happened on that platform.
A train pulled out of the station, and a moment later a train pulled in, heading in the other direction. That was the one that killed Faraday. Although Rowan couldn't see it, he grimaced as if he had.
You think someone killed him and made it look like he did it himself?
Rowan looked around to make sure they weren't being observed and spoke quietly.
If that's your only evidence, it's pretty weak. I know. So I kept digging.
She swiped back and replayed the scene of Faraday walking toward the station.
There were 5 witnesses. I couldn't track them down without digging into the Scythedom's records, and if I did that, they'd know I was looking. But it only makes sense that those witnesses would have gone up these stairs too, right? There were 18 people who went up the stairs around the time that Faraday died. Some of them probably got on this first train.
She pointed to the train leaving the station.
But not all of them. Of those 18 people, I was able to identify about half of them, and 3 of them were granted immunity that very day.
It was enough to take the wind out of Rowan and make him feel lightheaded.
They were bribed? To say it was a self-gleaning?
If you were just an ordinary citizen and witnessed one scythe killing another, and then were offered immunity to keep your mouth shut, what would you do?
Rowan wanted to believe he'd seek justice. But he thought back to the days before he became an apprentice, when the appearance of a scythe was the most frightening thing he could imagine.
I'd kiss the ring and keep my mouth shut.
Across the rotunda, the doors of the conclave chamber opened and the scythes began to file in.
Who do you think did it?
Rowan asked.
Who had the most to gain by getting Faraday out of the picture?
Neither of them needed to say it out loud. They both knew the answer. Rowan knew that Goddard was capable of unthinkable things. But would he kill another scythe? Rowan shook his head, not wanting to believe it.
That's not the only explanation, he told her. It might not have even been a scythe at all. Maybe it was the family member of someone he gleaned. Someone who wanted revenge. Anyone could have taken his ring, pushed him into the path of the train, and used the ring to give immunity to the witnesses. They'd have to stay quiet then, or they'd be considered accomplices.
Citra opened her mouth to refute it, but closed it again. It was possible. Even though using Faraday's ring would have frozen the killer's fingers, it was possible.
I didn't think of that, she said.
Or what about a Tonist? The Tone cults hate scythes.
The rotunda was quickly emptying. They left the alcove and moved toward the chamber doors.
You don't have enough facts to accuse anyone of anything, Rowan said.
You should let it sit for now.
Let it sit? You can't be serious,
I said, for now.
You'll have full access to the Scythedom's records once you're ordained, and you'll be able to prove exactly what happened. Citra stopped in her tracks.
What do you mean, once I'm ordained? It could just as easily be you, or is there something I'm missing?
Rowan pursed his lips, furious at himself for the slip.
Let's just get inside before they close the doors.
The rituals of Conclave were just as they had been before. The tolling of the dead, the washing of hands, grievances and discipline. Once again, an anonymous accusation was leveled against Scythe Goddard, this time accusing him of handing out immunity too freely.
"Who brings this accusation?" Goddard demanded. "Let the accuser stand, and I